Luter, Larkin, and Hunter.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning. Mr. McBride?
This is my first time, so please be easy on me. You mentioned earlier I'm not going
to... Is that a plea for mercy?
Gotta do something. You mentioned earlier not to go into the details of it. I'll just say that I am here representing three homeowners in the Pine Grove subdivision. It was originally a collection action in state court. We alleged that those collection actions were inappropriate because the board wasn't authorized to take those actions. And as a result, we believe that the defendant law firm violated the FDCPA in doing so.
I don't mean to pick on you, and I don't want to make your first appearance a bad one, but I will tell you I will tell you just in candor so you have an opportunity to address it. That what really interests me the most is the Rule 11 issue.
Okay.
Because it seemed to me that the district court overread the decision that where I was on the panel, actually. Is it Walker? Is that the one he said effectively said that you can't have a post-judgment motion for sanctions? And and it seems to me you clearly can. We've entertained them. Before we had earlier circuit precedent in Baker that made it clear you could have a post-judgment motion for sanctions. The Walker concern was a concern about whether the district court had basically ruled on and disposed of what was the offending misconduct of the lawyer, the Rule 11 violation, before the motion for sanctions was filed. And we don't have that here. And the motion for sanctions, it seems to me, was filed after the safe harbor time had passed, and so should have been entertained.
And Judge, I'll hop into that. Can I at least get on mine the reason that we appealed first, just so I can get it out of my head?
You can say whatever you want. I'm just telling you, that's what my concern is,
and
until you start talking about it. That you're not going to be addressing my main concern.
Okay.
You do whatever you like.
Then let me go ahead, since you've instructed me on how to do this, let me go ahead and address
it. And your brief is waived by not, addressing it. I just have a question.
Sure. The way I read those cases, obviously Baker is the older case, Walker is the more recent case. Mm-hmm. Walker does factually talk about the safe harbor provision. I think it does not explicitly say we are deciding this because of the safe harbor provision. And several district court cases in interpreting it, including the court below, all cite to this idea.
Seems to me the only reason
it's important for us to clarify, right? If Walker can be read as both consistent with Baker and as inconsistent with Baker, which way are we as a panel obligated to read Walker?
Well, again, I think Walker is the more recent case, so I think it is the case that actually
that
deals with Rule 11.
That hurts you.
Okay.
Because we have the prior panel precedent rule is that to the extent that there's a conflict, then we have to follow the earlier one, not the later one.
I don't think it does, respectfully, Judge, because the version of Rule 11 is different depending on which case we're talking about. Rule 11 was amended, and the amended language was discussed in Walker, while the preceding language was discussed in Baker.
So that makes your argument that they're not actually in conflict, which I think is a different argument. If they are in conflict, then we clearly have to follow the earlier case. But you are saying that they're not actually in conflict because Walker deals with a new provision, and therefore it doesn't conflict with Baker.
I guess technically, yes. I don't think they're in conflict because I think they're talking about two different versions of the rule. I think effectively Baker just doesn't tell
you. What's the difference in the version of the rule that would make Walker good law and Baker bad law.
Well, the language of the rule itself is the safe harbor. I think what you get...
And you just told me that that's not what Walker turns on.
I don't think it does, but what I was going to say is that
but
is the language...
Let's say it does. So if it does, that doesn't help you either.
Well, Judge, respectfully, though, the language of Walker doesn't turn on that, on the rule. The issue is if you look at the committee notes, if you look at the reasoning for Rule 11... The reason they put the safe harbor in is to discourage litigation. And the safe harbor was one of the ways to accomplish that. But I think if you look at the notes overall, the purpose of this was not to engage in extensive litigation. And what I will tell you is I think the rule in Walker makes more sense. And honestly, I think I'll probably have to concede, I don't know that you are necessarily bound by it. There is certainly the ability to look at this. It's not a jurisdictional issue. But if you look at the cases that talk about Walker and Baker, and if you look at some of the other district courts that have said, look, we don't entertain Rule 11 motions after the fact, I think the reality is if you allow this to happen, it's going to become commonplace and it's going to become extensive. It's going to encourage litigation because what you will have is litigants will file
I don't know what the harm is. As long as the party who was alleged to have violated Rule 11 has been put on notice and been given the 21-day opportunity to correct it, and that has passed without the district court taking care of the problem itself, then I don't understand what the harm is.
Sure, Judge, and I'm reaching my six-minute mark, so I'm going to try to give you a response, but I do want to pivot to my case. The harm, I think, Judge, is... The analogy I have is my dog goes nuts if it sees the mailman and he's behind the door, right? That door is the thing that allows him to go crazy. We open the door, he loves the guy, he licks him. I think this is the same kind of thing. If in Rule 11, if you can go and you can file this, if you can serve this motion on the front end and then wait and see how your motion plays out at the end, I think it encourages everybody to do it on the front end because the law is Rule 11 motions themselves are sanctionable. And so I think the tactic is I serve this motion, I have it in my back pocket, I play out the summary judgment, I let things go through, I win, I file the Rule 11 motion that I've served months ago and say, oh, well, you lost, you must have won. And then we start a new round of litigation.
But the standard for success on a Rule 11 motion is very far from you lost your case substantively. I mean, the standard is very high.
Agreed. And Judge, I think this case is an explanation for that. I think this is not the case substantively, although we're not really here on the substance of the Rule 11 motion. This isn't a Rule 11 type case. It was a, we lost a summary judgment motion on an evidentiary issue. But now, if you overturn this, we're going to go back, we're going to reopen the case, and we're going to have another round of litigation over this, did you frivolously file the case or not? It extends litigation. And what I will say in this case is, the bulk of the argument is not from the motion that was served. It is from an affidavit that was filed subsequent to the end of the case with a whole bunch of other stuff after the arguments raised in the motion.
But it costs obviously both sides money to litigate a Rule 11 sanction,
correct,
right? And so there are certain disincentives to doing it where it's right, where the Rule 11 sanction itself, motion itself is frivolous. But here, if the rule gives a party who makes a frivolous filing 21 days after the Rule 11 notice is served to reconsider and pull back that filing.
Right.
Why, once your client had 8 months, right, before the court dismissed it, why isn't that enough notice for you to consider whether or not your opponent was correct that Rule 11 sanctions might be necessary?
Well, I think the reality is we did consider that and we determined that the Rule 11 motion wasn't appropriate. We had a reasonable basis for proceeding the way we did.
Then you can feel confident that you would prevail
absolutely
at the district court once that's considered.
Well, absolutely. But I think the harm is that now we've taken a rule that is intended to minimize litigation and we are now encouraging exponential litigation. We are now reopening a case to fight about something that, quite frankly, we think is a frivolous... Well, excuse me. I don't think it's a frivolous to file the Rule 11. I think it's inappropriate based on the record. Judge, I think I've convinced you about as much as I'm going to be able to convince you on this in about the 3 minutes. I'd like to talk about my case real quick. And since I only have the 3 minutes, I think the most important thing, what our position is, and this is a position that I have to point out that the State Court of Henry County said was correct, that the board of the Homeowners Association board was never properly appointed because, and it did not have authority to issue assessments because the declarant was never properly assigned to Reggie, Georgia. And I think the trial court and the magistrate court glossed over the facts of the case, and in particular the timeline. And I'll tell you why I think that's important. The original declarant was the Knight Group, purchased the property, developed the property in 2006. 2008 happened. This happens factually in a lot of these situations. They went belly up. The loans from the bank get assigned to RL Reggie Finance, LLC, in 2011. In March of 2012, a year later, they assign all of their interests in those security deeds to Reggie, Georgia, different corporate entity. So all of the title has now passed to Reggie, Georgia as of March 23rd, 2012. The next thing that happens is we get a recorded assignment of declarant rights. Now, what the trial court focused on was the execution date of February 28th. That's not important. What the declaration says is in order to be the declarant, you have to both possess title for the purpose of development and sale, and you have to have a recorded instrument, recorded. It says that not only in the declaration and the definition of a declarant, but it also says that in later when it talks about the declarant rights, where it basically says, again, it's not effective until it's recorded. So the problem for RL Reggie Finance being the declarant, which is the position the defendant's taken and quite frankly how they've operated, is they needed two things, both title for the purpose of development, but also a recorded instrument. They didn't have those two things at the same time. At one time, they may have had a security interest, but they didn't have the assignment at that time. By the time the assignment happened in May, they didn't have a security interest in the property or title interest. In fact, the title belonged to Reggie Georgia.
What do you think qualifies as a security interest?
The
security deeds.
Yeah, they were assigned to them. So I think that's the important thing. And really, if you look, the whole case that we are focusing on, Georgia case, is the Hall versus Town Creek case. And basically says you can't start disregarding the corporate form. The declarant simply can't act as the board. And that's the situation we get in. When you're not actually assigned appropriately declarant rights and you start making these decisions, then it really runs afoul of that case. And the case is clear that those assessments aren't valid. If the assessments aren't valid, the debt's not valid. If the debt's not valid and you're representing it is or trying to collect on it, that's a violation of the FDCPA. And so, judges, I think the most important thing I can say is look at the record and that factual timeline in terms of the definition of declarant, the declarant rights, and then look at the timeline. Because the two things you need to be the declarant for Reggie Financial to operate as the declarant are those two things, and they don't happen at the same time. And I've run out of time, so we'll talk in a little bit.
You've saved 2 minutes, Mr. President. Morning.
John Luter with Luter, Larkin, and Hunter. Good portion of what we do is community association law, represent homeowners associations, townhomes, condos. A good portion of that is the collection of unpaid assessments. Got to pay your dues. Assessments are a consumer debt. They fall under the FDCPA. FDCPA passed in Congress in 1977 to stop abusive debt collection practices. It's great. We don't call people we don't call people in the evening, we don't call people in the morning, we don't call their neighbors.
I'm gonna, same as we asked your friend at the other table too, I'm gonna ask you to, let's touch on the sanctions issue first.
I agree with all your questions on that. I like where you're going, and I'm in full agreement. So, Baker,
so your argument is Baker and Walker are reconcilable.
Oh, completely.
Yeah. The Walker issue is a safe harbor issue. Baker makes it clear, though, that you can file a motion for sanctions after judgment. The district court just overread Walker, and we need to straighten it out.
That's exactly right. And not just this district court. There's many courts in this circuit that it's gone different ways. So it's a reasonable time after the final adjudication. We did 5 days. 2 of them were a weekend. And that reasonableness, you look at prejudice.
So long as the 21-day safe harbor has been met, right?
Oh, yeah. Yes. Had in Walker, had the offending pleading been ruled upon within the 21 days, that's Walker. That's not Baker. Two different cases. And it was...
You said reasonable time post-judgment, it being 5 days. Where does that come from?
Within Baker, actually Baker does that. Baker says a reasonable time post-adjudication.
You're saying that your period was 5 days and that is reasonable. Yeah, you're Baker, not saying that
was only
even
30
days.
Yeah. Baker was 30 days and they said it was reasonable, I think.
Correct.
I always thought there was a 30-day in the statute. I learned something in this case that the requirement is a reasonable time.
Yeah.
But I always thought it was post-judgment.
Yeah, I did too.
I misunderstood your argument. I thought you were saying it was a 5-day requirement somehow imposed. And I get it. It's reasonable time. That's what Baker says. And 5 days, if 30 days was reasonable in Baker, then 5 days clearly was here. That's your argument.
That's what we learned in law school. It's. I thought it was after. And then when I got that order from the district court, I was like, wow, I had to file this way before the court even looked at the merits of the case. So how would the court know that Rule 11 would be applicable if the court hasn't even looked at the merits of the case and adjudicated them? And how would we know how much attorney's fees to even seek?
Though there's not a requirement to file it after judgment either, right?
Oh, correct, correct. You can file it any time.
Any time after the 21-day safe harbor.
Right, and Walker was a perfect example because Walker was just such a narrow little issue. The attorney's fees were this. Our case, it just kept getting bigger and bigger because different things happened.
Yeah, Walker, the offending motion was disposed of within the 21 days, so there was not the opportunity to cure it.
That's exactly correct, right. Yep.
That's all it turns on.
Going back to our case, I was talking about the FDCPA, we're getting clobbered as a debt collector because what's happening is debtors, in particular debtors' attorneys, keep seeking to expand it. And this is a perfect case of where that's happening. And this is my first time before you, hopefully my only, so this is my opportunity to give my pitch as to what I'm hoping to hear as an opinion.
But you know, you may not be surprised to know that if we're this interested in a sanctions motion issue, that it might be because we thought that there might be a sanctions motion issue.
I thought that up front.
Do you understand that?
And oftentimes it's best to stop talking if you're already going that way. I can be done, but I do want to make sure there's a couple things I do want to hit real quick. It's after, their attack was, Dench. I mean, I'm sitting there listening to this. What if our firm was hired by Renaissance Bank to collect the debt against Lancaster because Mr. Hardwick signed that? It's like, why do we as the debt collector have to go and make sure that that's a valid assignment and figure all that out? Because if we don't do that, we're going to get sued. And that's exactly what happened here, is we were required to go back to an instrument that was recorded 7 years before we even started collections against these debtors and make the same. We had to look through 34 instruments and make the same determination as the debtor's attorney that this was not valid or otherwise we're being sued. We're constantly seeking. What happens as the debt collector is the first time we even know that a debtor or debtor's attorney is seeking to expand the FDCPA is we get sued, and then we get a call and say, hey, all these attorney's fees have been incurred. And it's in the record here. We were informed, hey, you've got 6 lawsuits. I will settle them for $5,000 each. Pay us $30,000. It was a shakedown is what we looked at this, and we said, we got to defend against these. And yes, it's been a significant amount of time and effort. I didn't want to be here. I did not put a request for oral argument. I saw it. I was like, oh, great. I got to come in December. And I'm thrilled to be here. So their first attack is on the assignment of declarant rights in 2019. We get into 2020, of March of 2020, and Mr. Webb, their attorney, is using the same exact assignment of declarant rights to get his clients put on to the HOA's board of directors.
Here's a statutory question for you.
Yes.
1692E2A, which I think is the first argument they were making, bars a debt collector from using any false, deceptive, or misleading representation or means in connection with the collection of any debt. And the false representation can include the character, amount, or legal status of any debt. Are there any cases, I did not look at this, are there any cases putting in a mens rea in terms of you have to know that that debt is false rather than it is false for reasons that you didn't know about or understand?
No, and that's exactly, thank you. So that's LeBlanc and Owen. This court has mentioned that in Owen, it cited back to LeBlanc and said the FDA has been described as a strict liability statute, and then you get the bona fide air defense. What I'm asking for, and this is put in our brief, is that debt collectors can reasonably rely upon their clients, the creditors. Other circuits have that as well. And debt collectors are the only attorneys that cannot rely upon our clients. I do community association law. I have no idea how these people got onto the board. I wasn't at the election. They come and tell me, I'm the president of the association. This is our board of directors. You know, according to the opposing side, I have to go back and get records of that election. Who was there? Was there a quorum? Was it properly notified? Were proxies used or not used towards the quorum? And if I miss any of that, that's not a proper board, and that client didn't have authority to hire me. And then that's the violation. And I would back up and say, that's not even a violation, that I'm not mischaracterizing the debt. You still owe the $400 of assessments. If my client doesn't have authority to hire me to collect it, that's not an FDCPA violation. But one of the other big things that they're trying to expand the FDCPA on is the attorney involvement. That was the Fred Hanna case, where his firm was kicking out 200 or so complaints per month per attorney, and that's the very first thing that the debtor saw, was they were getting a lawsuit, and the attorneys did not have any opportunity to review that in detail. Our attorneys, in each of these cases, there is the attorney's fee statement. It goes through, and every single thing, we say, okay, here's your collection letter. Here's your warning of lien. If you don't pay, we'll file a lien. We file the lien. Here's your warning of suit. If you don't pay, we'll file a suit. We file the suit. Then we go through the suit, and all of these have, you know, we're doing work just about every month on these things. One of them, it's a summary judgment, and then we're waiting for a, once a summary judgment is filed, the owner settled the case. And then two of the other ones, our client asked us to dismiss it because the attorney's fees from the other side just kept growing and growing and growing. Where I'm going with this is that argument that there has to be that meaningful involvement of the attorney, and that is not in the FDCPA. The district court noted that's not even a violation of the FDCPA, and I would love, hopefully, in this court to receive an opinion that that's not a violation of the FDCPA. Instead, I'd propose that if there's an attorney who does not have meaningful involvement, and that results in a violation, you look at the actual violation that occurred, not simply because the attorney is efficient. And in ours, we have our, you know, it's in the record. Our attorney was very, very involved in all of these cases. I'm not actually sure what else you'd like me to cover. Do you have any more questions? I'd be happy to sit down.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
McBride, you've saved 2 minutes.
So, Judge Grant, just to follow up on your question, yes, case law in the 11th Circuit indicates it's a strict liability statute. So there is a bona fide error defense. I 2 minutes, so I'm going to try to run through these. Bona fide error defense doesn't make sense in this case, particularly if you look at the evidence. And I think it's important to understand this is a summary judgment grant. We are the non-movements. We get all inferences in the record. Our position in this case has been they didn't meet their burden, so we don't have to put a bunch of evidence in to contradict things that don't speak to their burden. But the bona fide error defense, if you read the affidavit of Mr. Luter, what he basically says is, I asked my client, hey, are you the appropriately declared appointed board? And they're like, yep. And that was what he did to make sure, or that's what the firm did to make sure that they were authorized to collect that debt. I do not think you should expand to say, I can rely on whatever my client says, even under Rule 11, I have a duty to investigate and make sure the claims that I'm bringing are actually legitimate. If this board, under Georgia law, doesn't have the authority to collect, which is what the state court in Henry County found with other homeowners in this subdivision, then they don't have the right to ask for that money. So, and that is 1692F, talks about trying to collect on things that the agreement doesn't authorize. No doubt, the agreement, the declaration, allows to collect assessments if there is a validly appointed board. But when there's not, then that is a violation of the FDCPA to start trying to collect on these amounts. The issue here, this is a bigger, I mean, this is a bigger issue for Georgia residents, are this fact pattern happens a lot. This isn't like a credit card case where you sign up for it and there's sort of a back and forth and you know it. You buy a lot, you are subject to those declarations. In this case, I think there was testimony this board had never met, at least not in the 5 years prior to these suits going out, and then suddenly they start getting collection letters for $400 a year when they're like, I didn't even know I had a board. So I think that's why the FDCPA does apply to this case. I don't think this is a sanctionable conduct, but obviously I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
We are in recess until tomorrow morning.